Okay, where are we? Last time I was talking about the first couple of years of World War I. And what was the basic point there? Here you had the course of the conflict revealing what the balance of power actually was. These two blocks were of approximately equal power. That was reflected in the fact that you had a military stalemate, right? So you would expect policies to have adjusted to that fundamental military reality. You'd have expected people to realize that it was absurd to reach for total victory, that what you should strive for was a compromise peace. Because that was the political outcome that corresponded to the military reality of a balance of power. And you can make, you can, you know, if you're a realist man, you can make very powerful arguments for, especially for status quo countries like Britain, to have pressed for a compromise peace. You really want to destroy Germany? Crush Germany totally? If you're British, don't you need Germany to play a role in the European balance? Don't you need Germany as a counterweight to Russia? If Germany becomes a cipher, German power is totally crushed, then you have this huge Russian colossus in the east. What's going to restrain Russia in such a case? You know, that was the way people thought about those issues a century earlier. They're not thinking about them that way in World War I. This is a puzzle, right? What's the answer to the puzzle? Well, that was the central question of the lecture last time. And a lot of it has to do with the sorts of dynamics that come into play in such a situation in an age of mass warfare. The two sides are evenly balanced. And every last increment of power that you could squeeze out of your own people is of extraordinary importance because it might tip the balance. It might make the difference between victory and defeat. So you have to mobilize the energies of your own people. And you have to do that by making out that your enemy is the embodiment of evil, by stirring the fires of hatred against your enemy so that you could convince your people to make the effort needed to crush the enemy. And you can't talk about compromise because that's encourages defeatism. You know, what's the point of making a huge effort if it's just going to result in a compromise peace? You have to hold out the prospect of a glorious peace. Of a peace that's not simply turning back the clock the way things were before the war, but it's going to usher in a much better world. And you find this dynamic coming into play in every belligerent, regardless of regime type. You find it in Imperial Germany, you find it in France, you find it in Britain, you'll find it in the United States as well. Right? That there's this extraordinary change that takes place following the mobilization of the society and the entry into war. Notions of compromise, notions of equilibrium, you know, just don't come into play at all. There's also, I didn't talk about this last time, there's also an inter-allied aspect of this. And a war of this sort, which really shakes these societies to their foundations, there is this great fear that your ally is not going to be able to hold out. Your principal ally might very well defect and make a separate. And what this means is that you have to do what you can to encourage your ally to hold out by going along with the ally's annexationist aspirations. Riding there at the expense of your enemy. Right? So Britain and France basically now something they would never have done before the war. They support the idea of Russia taking over control of the Turkish Straits. The Russians for the airport support French annexationism, not just in getting Alsace-Lorraine back, but in making acquisitions even in the Rhineland. There's this famous meeting where the Tsar is speaking with a French leader during the war, and he says, take Mainz, take Koblenz, go further still if you judge it useful. Right? People in the whole debate about German war guilt, the whole debate about the Fischer thesis and so on, a lot of the people who made this argument that Germany was responsible for the war, they pointed to the annexationist goals that the German government embraced very soon after the outbreak of the war in September of 1914. Right? The fact that the German government opted for an annexationist policy after the war broke out, that doesn't quite prove that they engineered the war with those goals in mind. But the real problem with that way of looking at things was that this was not unique to Germany. All the major belligerents in Europe had, rather far-reaching war aims policies. The code language was not hard to decipher. The term that was used was guarantees against the recurrence of regression. Well, guarantees meant France had to be in the Rhineland, so on. Okay. So with those kinds of dynamics at play, with none of the belligerents willing really to accept a compromise peace, a negotiated settlement was just not in the cards. But what this meant was that the war would be decided on the battlefield, right? And it placed an enormous premium on developing tactics, developing strategies, developing weapons that could tip the balance on the battlefield, that could be decisive militarily, right? And so, as I talked about this, the whole dynamic of weapons development during the war, poison gas and ultimately the development of the tank and the submarine also is to be understood in these terms. These weapons promised or opened up the possibility that they could be militarily decisive. The war would be decided militarily, so therefore there was this great premium on developing new weapons, new strategies, and so on, right? So there was a reaching for what would be militarily decisive in terms of weapons and strategies, but also this determined the diplomacy of the war, because international politics doesn't stop when wars break out. They continue. And in this case, the basic question was the intervention of neutrals. And above all, the most important neutral, greatest, already by this time, the greatest industrial power in the world, the United States of America. How would America enter? And in fact, America's intervention in the war in April 1917 turned out to be decisive. After America came in, really, there was no question what the outcome would be. Same point you can make about World War II. All right? So, the issue for us here today is, how is the American intervention to be understood? And once again, to kind of bring that issue into focus, we look at what international relations theorists have had to say about it, and how the interpretation of American intervention in the First World War that they present supports general arguments about how international politics works. And this case is very revealing in this connection. It relates very directly to all these core issues that lie at the heart of this field. The core argument between realists and liberals comes into focus when you think through these issues in the context of U.S. intervention in the First World War. And one of the main writers who has used this particular case as one of its fundamental cases supporting his whole interpretation of how great power politics works is John Mearsheimer. That book, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, that I've referred to a number of times in the course of her. And Mearsheimer has a very distinct interpretation of it. His whole notion is that what countries want to do is they want as much power as possible. That means becoming the dominant power in their region. Although they'd love to be the dominant power in the whole world, but that's beyond their reach. The most they could realistically hope for is to become the hegemon in their own region. But once they become a hegemon in their own region, they still have to worry about what goes on in other regions, because if a rival hegemon emerges in some other important region, that rival hegemon can make real trouble for you, can intervene in your backyard and so on. So you have to be concerned about this, right? And so what's the basis for this theory? Essentially, it's a generalization from the American experience in the 20th century. Because Mearsheimer says there's been only one power that's achieved that status of regional hegemon in modern times. That's the United States of America. It's the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere. Right? Nevertheless, the Americans couldn't turn their back on the rest of the world. But they opted for a policy of, according to Mearsheimer, this is, of if there's a threat in some other region and some other power there is reaching for hegemony in some other region, then the local great powers would be primarily responsible for dealing with that problem. In other words, for balancing against a would-be hegemon in some other region. Right? And it's only when they can't do it that America feels that it has to. It prefers not to intervene. It prefers to allow the local great powers to do the job. It prefers to basically be, you know, a free rider on it. But sometimes they can't do it. And when they can't do it by themselves, well, then America has to throw its own power in the balance. And Mearsheimer says the United States did this four times in the course of the 20th century. In 1917, 1941 against both Germany and Japan, so that counts as two separate times, and against the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And the whole Mearsheimer theory is essentially a generalization from that American experience. Right? So you can see that this case of 1917 plays a very important role in supporting that whole line of argument. And in fact, Mearsheimer says specifically that that's why the Americans intervened in the war. It's like they held out, you know, thinking that the Entente could balance Germany by themselves. But by 1917, it seemed that the Entente would not be able to do it. Therefore, America intervened. He says, the United States entered World War I in good part because it thought that Germany was gaining the upper hand on the Triple Entente and was likely to win the war and become a European hegemon. All right? Why did they think this? And he then just unwraps the argument, you know, and spells it out. You know, he talks about the three Entente powers. In the case of Russia was on the verge of a revolution, as you all know. Russia had a revolution in 1917. Right? He talks about France in the spring of 1917, there were all these great mutinies in the French army. Talks about Britain. Britain was in better shape, but still, Britain was running out of money. You know, Britain was kind of nearing the end of her rope. And then he concludes the paragraph in which he spelled out all these things by saying that, consequently, the United States was forced to enter the war in the spring of 1917 to bolster the Triple Entente and prevent a German victory. Okay? Well, you realize, this is why this kind of work is so terrific, because It's based on this on a strong theoretical conviction, a conviction about how international politics has to work. And Mearsheimer has the courage of his convictions. He's going to say these things regardless of how it conflicts with standard historical views. Right? So this is not the standard historical interpretation. Standard historical interpretation is, the United States is a liberal country. It doesn't think in power political terms. Doesn't think in terms of balance of power and stuff like that. It intervenes for moral reasons. It intervenes because Germany is this terrible, autocracy, and the democracies of Britain and France are threatened, and so on. You've heard that whole line. And especially, who's the great champion of liberal foreign policy in American history? Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson, American president at this time. He's the one who made the decision to intervene. He certainly doesn't think in balance of power terms. He thinks in moral terms. That's the standard line of argument that you get in the historical literature. Mearsheimer, he knows how international politics works, and he's going to interpret American policy in these terms. Right? How are you to make up your mind about these things? You're going to say, well, Mearsheimer can't be right because the standard view has to be correct. Well, standard view is often wrong. You gotta look at the evidence that he presents to support his point of view. And he gives a footnote. a footnote to that, to the argument in that paragraph. And he cites a number of works to support it. One of which is the Kennan article that you're reading for the class this week. That Kennan article, it's terrific. If there's one thing in this class that I'd like you to read with some care, in fact, to read more than once, and indeed to read even after this class is over, it's that Kennan article. And I'll just tell you, it had an enormous impact on my own thinking of international politics, because it's a whole different way of approaching these issues about what foreign policy should be. Kennan himself is, and I don't know how much you know about him, is enormously influential. He's a diplomat, but he also. He wrote very well, and he spoke out in public a lot and participated in the public debate, and had a real impact on the way a lot of people, including myself, came to think about international politics. But it's not theory in the sense of being abstract and dealing with kind of conceptual issues. It's not like Waltz, for example. He makes his argument in the guise of making a historical argument. This lecture that you're reading this week on World War I is from a series of lectures he gave, I think it was in 1949, and the book was published, I think, in 1950. The book is called American Diplomacy. And in these lectures, he kind of gave his take on the history of American foreign policy in such a way that you could see what his general perspective was on foreign policy, and you could appreciate the fact that he was doing more than just trying to help you understand a historical process. He was trying to kind of get at these core issues about how foreign policy should be conducted, especially in the case of the United States. Where do we go wrong? How should we, what are the general principles which should serve as guideposts to our foreign policy? And you get a sense for that by looking at how we screwed up in the past. Right? Okay, so so what's the Kennan argument in that article? Saying he's not an admirer of Woodrow Wilson's. You know how they always have these polls of historians about who the great presidents are, and Wilson is always right up there with you know, like number four, number five, right after Thomas Jefferson or whatever. Kennett thinks that the U.S. policy was a disaster. And he looks, he says, you look at the American policy in this period. Before we got into the war, couldn't care less about Europe. These issues are, you know, just trivial, unimportant from our point of view. And as a matter of fact, it's like, what do you expect from these Europeans? They have this terrible political system. They're caught up in all these kind of antiquated notions of this, where they struggle for power and all this kind of silly stuff like that. And we're in America. We don't have to deal with that kind of thing anymore. Right? We don't want to get involved. And then the Germans resume the submarine war. The Americans decide, how dare they? How dare they attack us like this? And we get involved in World War One. And like from one day to the next, the whole American attitude changes. Now Germany is the source of all evil. Now the whole German system has to be totally crushed. and listen to kind of Kenneth's discussion of this. Let's see, where would it be? 65. He says, day before yesterday, let's say, the issues at stake between ourselves and another power are not worth the life of a single American boy. Today, nothing else counts at all. Our cause is holy. The cost is no consideration. Violence must know no limitations short of unconditional surrender. And he says, well, now I know the answer to this one. A democracy is peace-loving. It does not like to go to war. It's slow to rise to provocation. When it has once been provoked to the point where it must grasp the sword, it does not easily forgive its adversary for having produced this situation. The fact of the provocation then becomes itself the issue. Democracy fights in anger. It fights for the very reason that it was forced to go to war. It fights to punish the power that was rash enough and hostile enough to provoke it. To teach that power a lesson, it will not forget, to prevent the thing from happening again. Such a war must be carried to the bitter end. And then he goes on, he says, this is just childish. This is not the way a serious country should conduct a foreign policy. You know, just taking revenge like that. He says, but I sometimes wonder whether in this respect the democracy is not uncomfortably similar to one of those prehistoric monsters with a body as long as this room and a brain the size of a pin. He lies there in his comfortable primeval mud and pays little attention to his environment. He's slow to wrath. In fact, you practically have to whack his tail off to make him aware that his interests are being disturbed. But once he grasps this, he lays about him with such blind determination that he not only destroys his adversary, but largely wrecks his native habitat. Right? See, that's Wilson, right? Wilson. Says before he went to the war, Wilson took a very, you know, moderate line. Wilson, Wilson gave a very famous speech. January 1917, going to the war in April, so it's before the declaration of war. January 1917, very famous speech. Peace without victory speech. It's a call for a negotiated peace, a moderate peace, right? A compromise peace. Forget about these extravagant war aims. The crucial thing is to end the war, right? As soon as we go into the war in April, all that is just thrown out the window. Now Germany is the embodiment of evil. Germany has to be crushed. and Kennedy does this really nice thing. He kind of quotes the Peace Without Victory speech. And he says, as late as January 1917, Wilson was still arguing against total victory. A peace forced, this is a quote from Wilson, a peace forced upon the loser, a victor's terms imposed upon the vanquished, you know, Wilson says, would be accepted in humiliation, under duress, at an intolerable sacrifice, and would leave a sting, a resentment, a bitter memory upon which terms of peace would rest as upon quicksand. And then he actually talks about what happened in 1918, the kind of peace that was imposed upon Germany following this total victory. And he says, and in fact, it did rest upon quicksand. It was a peace that was that left a sting and a resentment and caused humiliation and so on. He goes and quotes Wilson's own words. Something's basically wrong here. So as I said, Mearsheimer cited this Kennan article to support his theory. How would Kennan react to the Mearsheimer theory? Mearsheimer says, oh, the Americans went to the war for the sake of the balance of power. Kennan would have said, I wish that had been American policy. That's what American policy should have been. If American policy had been rooted in those conceptions, then Americans would have been interested in the balance of power in Europe all along. Maybe American power would have been committed to the maintenance of the balance, and if so, it would have been able to head off the war, or certainly bring it to a reasonable conclusion on the basis of a moderate settlement. Kennan, cited by Mearsheimer in support of the Mearsheimer thesis, but it's basically taking the opposite line. Right? Well, that's interesting. That's important in itself. But it doesn't quite answer the question that we're concerned with today, which is why, in fact, did America intervene in the war? Now, this was a big issue in the interwar period. Because what you have to remember after the war ended in 1918 and the Treaty of Versailles was signed in 1919 is that there was this enormous reaction to the whole Wilsonian program. Disenchantment, disillusion. He had promised a war to end the war, a war to make the world safe for democracy. These two of the famous Wilson slogans from the day. And in fact, you had what was obviously from the start going to be a very unstable peace. In fact, one of the key things to bear in mind about the interwar period is that this peace, which resulted from the victory of the three great Western democracies in 1918, this peace, which is the only major peace in the history of great power politics to be imposed by the Western democracies and by them alone, also turned out to be the most unstable peace in the history of great power politics. And you have to ask yourself, is there any connection between those two things? Right? People like Kennan think that there really is. They're not too keen on democracy and the ability of democratic governments to conduct an effective foreign policy. So as I said, there was this sense of disenchantment after 1919. We had been sold a bill of goods. America had been taken into the war on false premises. And people looking for alternate explanations to the kind of official propaganda line during the war about why America had gone in. The threat to freedom posed by Germany, no, people didn't believe that. And so they looked for things going on behind the scenes, British propaganda, the fact that all kinds of loans were given to the British, that there was a kind of a sympathy between the upper class in the United States and their British counterparts and so on. And these notions inspired a whole literature, especially in the 1930s, most important work in this genre was Walter Millis's Road to War, Book of the Month Club selection, I think, 1936. Yeah? Millis, M-I-L-L-I-S. And that whole set of notions inspired the neutrality legislation in the United States in the 1930s, which played a rather important role in the whole story of the origins of the Second World War. And so this issue is an issue of considerable political importance. Why had the United States gone into the war? It's true. There was kind of an economic alliance. The British controlled the seas. Germany couldn't import from the United States. But the British could. And they bought a lot of supplies in the United States. These supplies were initially financed by the British themselves, liquidated assets in order to do so. This led to a great increase in demand in the United States, an expansion of the money supply in the United States, an inflationary boom. The United States was enjoying economic boom before we went into the war, and the boom was connected with the continuation of these orders from Britain and France. And when the British kind of ran out of money, they were able to borrow money in New York. There was a kind of alliance between the British and Morgan Bank, which is a very important bank in the United States in those days. And a lot of people who didn't want the United States to intervene in the war were worried about the consequences of this, most notably Wilson's first Secretary of State, a major political figure in his own right, William Jennings Bryan, wanted to kind of take his distance from all this, put limits on how much the United States was committing itself economically to the side of the Entente. Right. And this led to a conflict between Wilson and Bryan, leading to Bryan's resignation and his replacement by Robert Lansing. Right. So people were worried that the United States was leaning too much to the British side and acquiring too great an interest in preventing a defeat of the British simply by virtue of the fact we had this economic interest there. Right. So people point to these things, and always when people make arguments of this sort, they look at one side of the ledger. There are plenty of counter-arguments, though, that you can make. If economic interests are so important, or as important as all that, why didn't the United States then insist on trade with both sides, right? We didn't have to accept the British blockade of Germany. It's the whole notion of neutral rights, as it was understood in those days. A belligerent had the right to trade and to engage in most forms of trade with a non-belligerent like the United States had the right to trade with both Germany and with Britain, right? Except in what was called contraband of war, ammunition, weapons, and so on. But food and things like that, yeah, we had the right to trade with everybody. Plus, we had the right to trade with neutrals that shared a common border with Germany, like Holland and Denmark. Okay, but the British wouldn't even allow that, you know. Suppose the Americans had said to the British, you want to be able to trade with us? You also have to allow us to trade with Germany. The Germans, the British would have had to give in. We know from their documents that they would have given in, the Americans. And if economic interests were all the Americans cared about, they could have used their economic power to force open not just the Entente market, but also the market of the Central Power. They don't do that, you see. They acquiesce in the British blockade of Germany, including the limitations on American trade with Holland, Denmark, and so on. Okay. If all they cared about was the prosperity resulting from this inflationary boom, well, you can create inflation by fiat. You just expand your own money supply if you want to do it. If economics was so important to them as all that, then why didn't they allow this process to continue by taking a more generous line on reconstruction loans after the war? Right? But instead they allowed the inflationary boom to collapse, and we had a big depression that began in late 1920. The depression of 1920-1921 was similar in size, if not in duration, to the Great Depression of the 1930s. Right? So when you start kind of probing, you see that there are a lot of problems to the argument that the taproot of American policy was economic. America was siding with the British, in effect. All right. Yeah. Yeah. I could see this. It's like, that's this whole picture of the policy process. It's this total mess. You know, it's like all these different things come into play in different ways with different people, and people are kind of like half conscious of these things, right? That's a fair point. The question is, how do you gauge? How do you gauge how important one kind of factor is opposed to the other, right? And to my mind, the only answer is you try and do these kind of counterfactual thought experiments. You know, if this stuff was as important as people say, then wouldn't you expect to find X, Y, and Z? Do you find it? Doesn't mean it doesn't play any role at all. It just is a question of how much weight to kind of give these things. Yeah. This is the Zimmerman telegram. Does everyone know what this is? This is the Germans made this kind of offer to Mexico that if Germany got involved in a war with the United States, and if Mexico came in on the German side, the Mexicans would be able to get back a lot of the territory that they lost to the United States in the 19th century. This whole business is in line kind of with the Mearsheimer theory about the fear that a rival hegemon is going to intervene in your backyard. You don't get the sense when you look at the documents from early 1917, right, that whole business played a very direct role. Again, it's this kind of argument. You throw it into the pot. It's one of the things that leads the United States to have this kind of distaste for Germany and to kind of tilt toward the Entente side, but it's not an argument for intervention, right? It's an argument for, we'll defend our own hemisphere and let the Europeans kind of take care of themselves, right? Yeah? Then why don't they go into the war earlier, right? Why don't they commit their power to the defense of democracy early? It's because they don't have that much sympathy as a nation. You have a country, the United States is a huge country, and a lot of people in the heartland of the United States don't want to get involved in these European wars. A lot of people are, for example, German ancestry or Irish, who don't like the British for other reasons. And if you Wilson campaigned on a platform in November of 1916, just a few months before he took us into the war, of he kept us out of war. Now he's only doing that because he knows what the public opinion was. So you can't say, oh. I mean, there's a certain natural sympathy. But that natural sympathy is not strong enough to determine policy. So you have to say, you know, what's crucial? What plays the key role, on the margin? Yeah? Well, this kind of Anglo-Saxon upper class was in the Northeast, and these are people, J.P. Morgan, people like that. They had the sympathy with the British, but they're Republicans, right? They're not Wilson's natural constituency, the people he's supposed to represent. It's the West and the South. You know, these are, and the Democrats had been for years. You know, the whole progressive movement was, you know, against the robber barons, against the kind of old upper class. You're going to allow these people to kind of pull the strings and treat you like marionettes? Right? You see what I'm saying? Yeah, these are factors, but it's very hard to make kind of these direct linkages there. The people who defended Wilson's policy, they said, well, why did the United States go into the war? It was over the issue of the German decision to launch an unrestricted submarine campaign of blockade against the British Isles. All right. And the argument was, the Germans knew what they were doing. This is the argument made by people who defend the Wilson policy. American policy had been since, for quite some time, to say that it was unacceptable, it was intolerable that the Germans should conduct this submarine war against sink American ships, basically. We had a right to trade with the British. The German answer to that was, if you're standing up for your rights as a neutral under the laws of war, why aren't you standing up to the British about your right to trade with us as well? And the answer to that was, well, if we did that, and we could force the British to allow us to trade with everybody, then that basically would be an unneutral act. Because the main pillar of British power is the Royal Navy. A navy is effective because of blockade. And now, the Americans would say, you're asking us to tell the British that they should throw their navy out in the garbage because they can't use the navy to blockade you? Right? If we did that, we'd be basically doing something unneutral because we'd be taking an act that was very hostile to the British. Now the important thing to note about this argument is that whatever the United States does is going to have some impact on the situation in Europe. It can't simply be neutral in the sense of just turning its back. Any American action is going to have an effect. If they insist on neutral rights with everybody, then that's going to have an anti-British effect, right? Well, people look at this and they say, what this then means is that you have to try and figure out why it was that the American government pursued the policy it did, which is this policy of acquiescing in the British blockade of Germany, but deciding to go to war in the event that the Germans launched this counter-blockade of Britain, the submarine blockade. Can you say that balance of power considerations didn't come into play at all here? Why on earth would the Americans up for such a policy if the outcome of the war in Europe was a matter of utter indifference to them? It's like, oh, we're insisting on neutral rights, of course, in this very asymmetric way. If the Germans use their submarines to do to Britain what Britain has been doing to Germany with the Royal Navy, then we'll go to war against Germany, right? Regardless of whether we have any political interest in the conflict. We're so committed to our neutral rights that we're going to go to war regardless of whether it makes sense in political terms. Is that, to go to war basically is an act of revenge on the Germans for sinking some of their ships? Is that the way a great nation would behave? You know, people find this so hard to believe that they say, well, there must be a deeper rationale. They must have been thinking in power. That's the kind of taproot of the line of argument that you find in Mearsheimer. The problem is that when you look at the documents, you just don't see it. You don't see Wilson thinking in those terms, in parapolitical terms. Right? You have this whole problem of, if power politics is crucial, why was it that the United States didn't intervene earlier? Why was it that after the United States intervened, it couldn't think in parapolitical terms, was thinking just in terms of crushing the Germans? Right? It's like, and you do, again, you do one of these counterfactual thought experiments. If there had been no submarine war, would the United States then have intervened because of the sense that Russia and France, maybe even Britain as well, couldn't do the job by themselves, that they were on their last legs? Hard to see it. Hard to see it. Right? So when you look at the evidence, you say, "This is, you know, it's kind of profoundly puzzling." It's like the policy isn't really anchored in a clear philosophy of how international politics works, of what America's role in the system should actually be. And so it kind of boils down to this notion of, well, we have our neutral rights, we're going to stand up for our neutral rights. If this means going to war with Germany, we're going to go to war with Germany. And since the Germans have forced us into this, that means that they're a criminal nation, and therefore they're going to be crushed. That's not a kind of a serious policy, and that's the kind of policy that's bound to have, you know, really questionable consequences. Right? Maybe a little bit about what the consequences were. Okay. You find the Americans, as soon as they go in the war, just totally changing their political life. All thought of peace without victory disappears from American rhetoric. All notions of compromise peace disappear. Now it's all these kind of very grandiose war aims, remaking the entire world. So that instead of a balance of power, Wilson says you're going to have a community of power. But the crucial thing is that American resources are such, and the exhaustion of the European powers was such, that American intervention in the war was going to be militarily decisive. Now, it took a while to raise and train and arm and transport and an American army to Europe, and once it was there, to deploy to the front. As a matter of fact, the American army that fought in Europe in 1918 was armed largely by the French, if you can believe it. It took a while. But once the American troops came in, the impact was, no, on the battlefield, it was bound to be decisive. But even before that, America's entry into the war had a dramatic impact on the position of the Entente, because it meant that American resources were now open to them, that they can get whatever they needed in terms of supplies from the United States, and that the American Navy would help make sure that those supplies got to Europe. So what I'll do next time is I'll tell the story of the very end of the war, the kind of also the economic and financial system that came into being, and the kind of peace that developed from this kind of